right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Movie Commentary Podcast. We are continuing and actually finishing up our look at the HBO series Chernobyl, the five-episode miniseries released in 2019. We have gone through all the episodes up until this point, the first four episodes, and now we are on the last episode titled Vinchnaya Pamyat. And this episode is now going to, this episode is going to dive into basically the cause of the Chernobyl disaster and basically the trial of Dyatlov, Fomin, and Brukhanov that will basically expose what actually happened in the that caused Chernobyl to explode. Little disclaimer, this is my favorite episode of the miniseries, mainly because it dives into the why and the how of Chernobyl, kind of like how it exploded, and for a lot of people, kind of like the why it exploded and all that kind of stuff. There's going to be some points in this where I'll go off in some tangents. I'll try to keep it fairly concise and fairly packed into the episode. I'll try my best to follow along, but if I go off on tangents because I'm taking a lot of time to explain something, then I definitely apologize. Just a disclaimer that after this episode is released, a very short time after this episode is released, I will be releasing essentially a edited together version of this episode, I'll basically take all five of these episodes and essentially make combine them into one very long, you know, kind of episode, so that if you want to listen to it from beginning to end and all in one shot, that you can do that. So just keep on the lookout for that. You know, make sure you guys are also keeping up with the other podcasts that I have been releasing as well. And without further ado, let us go ahead and start the final episode. Start her up here. Now, this last episode actually starts in a bit of a pretty interesting spot, actually. This actually takes us to before the disaster actually took place. This actually is taking place on April 25th. This is basically the day before the disaster took place, and it's showing the city of Pripyat kind of going about its business. They're kind of showing some people that, you know, we've kind of come to know and love in this, you know, in the series. You know, we just saw Alexander Yevchenko, the guy that actually passed away, who actually in real life survived. We're seeing him with his young son. We saw Anatoly Sitnikov with one of his significant others. We're going back to Vasily and Lyudmila Ignatenko before, you know, they were plunged into their terrible ordeal. You know, see Vasily before, you know, he suffered all of his radiation burns and all that kind of stuff. And in the background, we see a man walking to work, and this man is Anatoly Dyatlov, holding a briefcase and walking his way to work with a smoke in his mouth. That's one thing I haven't mentioned is a lot of smoking in this episode, in this series. You know, of course, back in the 80s, that's kind of, again, something that would have probably been prevalent, is, you know, the smoking, and, you know, a lot more smoking than what we have now. Now, this was actually, so that little tidbit of Dyatlov walking to work is actually quite true. He actually did walk to the power plant every day from his house in Pripyat, which was quite a bit of a walk. And they're showing him now with the chief engineer Nikolai Fomin, played by Adrian Rollins. Again, for those of you that missed my first episode, I highly recommend checking that out. Adrian Rollins, who plays the chief engineer, Nikolai Fomin. He was also famous for playing James Potter in the Harry Potter series. Does not look anything like James Potter, so they do a great job of makeup in this and making him look like Fomin. And they're having a meeting with Brukhanov here, and they're talking, and they're having this little discussion, Dyatlov and Fomin, before Brukhanov comes in for the meeting. And essentially, Fomin is telling Dyatlov that they're thinking about promoting Brukhanov I'm going to take Brekhanov's old job, and then, you know, we need somebody to move up and take my old job as chief engineer. Now, this actually was something that was kind of steeped in reality. The way that I had read it was that there was this general sense of promotion that was about to happen with these three gentlemen. Brekhanov had already been approved before this disaster took place. He was going to get promoted to a pretty swanky job in Kiev, in which he could, you know, be a lot more, kind of oversee a lot more power plants and whatnot. And it was thought that Nikolai Fomin, who was the chief engineer, was going to take over Brekhanov's job, who was the plant manager. And Dyatlov was the guy that if Fomin took the plant manager job, Dyatlov, who was the deputy chief engineer, he wanted the chief engineer job. Dyatlov was described as being very much wanting a promotion. He was very much wanting to get out of what they call like the workers' floor. He basically wanted to take like a more managerial desk job. He wanted to get out of the workplace and get more into an administrator office type job. And the way that they're talking about is that they're now setting up this idea of the safety test. And essentially, what they're talking about is Brekhanov wants this. They're trying to get this safety test done that they've been trying to get done for quite a long time. And what they've discovered is that they've run into some problems with that safety test, mainly because they have this grid controller in Kiev who says, "Hey, we need to keep the reactors on because we need to have all the power we can." Because it was towards the end of the month of April. They had all these kind of like end of the month quotas and all this other stuff kind of coming into place. And so they had to keep the reactor on during the day. So what was decided was that we're going to do what they called the rundown test later at night. And then they were going to run the safety test then. And essentially, the whole idea of the safety test and having to not shut down and not scrap the test until later, this is going to come up later in the trial as something that is a very large contributor to the disaster of Chernobyl. You know, it's one of the instances where the disaster could have been stopped, but it wasn't. So now we have cut forward. We finished up that scene with Brekhanov, Fomin, and Dyatlov, and now we have gone forward in time about 2 years, actually, to March of 1987. This is months and months after the Chernobyl disaster took place. We're back in Moscow. Legasov here is kind of they're portraying is that the crisis in Chernobyl essentially is kind of behind him. It's not really dominating his life anymore. He's kind of put it behind him. And they're talking, and he's talking to this one character. And again, I forget his name because they don't really say it a whole lot in the series. But this character who's essentially the chairman of the KGB, and this chairman comes in, and he actually literally gets one of his men to basically take Legasov off the streets, and they kind of have this meeting in the back of a car, kind of a pretty shady, like, you know, mob kind of vibe to it, if you're really wondering about it. But they're basically describing, you know, what Legasov talked about in Vienna. So if you remember from the last episode, we ended with this whole idea that Legasov was going to go to Vienna to this conference with, you know, hundreds of different scientists and all these, like, you know, different nuclear, you know, and members of the nuclear community across, you know, Europe and across the world. And he basically was going to tell the world in Vienna what had happened at Chernobyl. And the KGB chairman here is essentially telling him, like, "Hey, good job, you know, and you basically, you know, told him everything and all that kind of stuff." And in reality, Legasov did go to Vienna, and he actually did kind of, and I say the word kind of because he didn't tell them everything, but he did The way that they're talking about it in here is that Legasov talked unlike any Soviet scientist that had ever talked before, because he was admitting that there were a lot of problems with the nuclear industry. You know, he was admitting that there were safety regulations that were ignored. He was admitting that there were training deficits, that, you know, that there were people that were undertrained for the job. You know, he admitted a lot of, you know, the faults and the more human error, kind of putting the blame a lot onto you know, the people that had really, you know, been in charge of the reactor that night. He didn't tell them everything. In fact, he was quoted as saying, "I told the truth. I didn't lie in Vienna, but I did not tell the full truth." And the reason is he honestly couldn't. Because the thing with Legasov is that he was traveling abroad out of the Soviet Union, and if that were to happen, he was going to be followed by KGB agents, and there were going to be people there that, you know, were basically keeping an eye on him for fear of defection. So the whole idea that he could basically spill all the beans and tell them everything that had taken place, just, it wasn't feasible at the time. Now, Legasov ended up kind of becoming, you know, he ended up seeing the error in his ways and actually then began a crusade to actually tell the truth. And I'm going to kind of hold on to that. I'm going to end this and kind of hold on to that, because that's actually something that we see kind of happen right at the end of this episode, is kind of what happens with Legasov. So we're going to hold. So we're going to pause that thought, and we're going to kind of go back to that. But anyway, so in this, and so now, kind of catching up with the scene here, Legasov is met with Alana Homyuk, and they are basically talking in his apartment in Moscow. And Homyuk is essentially kind of scolding him for not telling him the whole truth in Vienna, you know, with the whole thing I just described and whatnot. And one of the instances that we saw before, one of the things that we saw before this scene took place was Legasov was kind of going through his hair, and he was pulling out tufts of his hair. You could see that his hair was starting to fall out. It was around this time, you know, around the start of this, around in 1987, where he started to experience bouts of ill health effects, and he was being admitted to the hospital several times. And he, I believe there was nausea. He was vomiting all the time. You know, he had, you know, cramps and all that kind of stuff. You know, he was definitely in ill health, and that was one of the contributing factors to his, you know, eventual suicide. It goes again, you know, that's the thing that we literally start this miniseries with, is the suicide of Legasov. And not only that, Legasov actually commits suicide. No, he doesn't commit suicide without having tried it before. Like, he had actually injected, I believe it was, he had tried to kill himself by sleeping pills. He had tried to do a whole lot of, like, other stuff, but he essentially didn't, you know, because he had become so disillusioned. And again, I'm going to try and hold on to more Legasov kind of prologue stuff epilogue stuff till the end. But knowing now that, you know, already knowing that he committed suicide, you know, he definitely tried to commit suicide more than once, you know, before he, you know, ended up succeeding, you know, 2 years after the accident at Chernobyl. So, and then, so yet again, you got Alana Homyuk here, who is trying to basically do what's right. And I love the visual kind of, the visual storytelling that they give with Homyuk here, that she essentially produces a big stack of notebooks to show Legasov. And she points to these notebooks and tells Legasov, okay, these are the people that I've talked to that are now dead. These are the people that I've talked to that are still alive. And the people and the list and the pile of notebooks that are of people that are now dead is a lot larger than the one of the people that are still alive. So yet again, it's something that another thing that kind of weighs on this, you know, on this character here, of the fact that he's there's still, you know, he still has a heavy burden to bear with this whole disaster taking place, and a burden that he bared basically for the rest of his life, trying to, you know, fix this disaster, which ultimately he did his best, but also the government, you know, and the state prevented him from doing a whole lot of anything about it. So now we have Legasov and Shcherbina. We have more Shcherbina again. And we are now being transported to the city of Chernobyl, which is about 14 to 20 kilometers away from the actual power plant itself. Now, they're going back into Chernobyl, essentially the exclusion zone, in order to have the trial. Now this is a real trial that took place that essentially is, you know, prosecuting Viktor Prokhanov, Nikolai Fomin, and Anatoly Dyatlov. Now, they actually had more men that, they actually had another, I think they had two other men, actually, I think maybe even three other men that were being prosecuted at the trial for, you know, basically negligence and all that kind of stuff. And this trial, there's a little bit of, you know, dramatic license that's taken place here, because one, they're showing Boris Shcherbina, Alana Holmyuk, and Valery Legasov basically, you know, residing at this trial and basically giving, you know, expert testimony and all that kind of stuff, where in reality, they were not anywhere close to the trial. They were not at the trial. This trial actually goes a lot differently than the way that they portray it here, but the way that they were describing it is that, you know, the people that, you know, they could have had other people that were the real life people that were at this trial to basically kind of showcase what was happening, what happened inside of the reactor. But, you know, we also really wouldn't have cared, you know, after spending so much time with, you know, Shcherbina, Holmyuk, and Legasov. So again, there's a little bit of a license taking place because of these three characters actually being in this trial. Now, one might ask yourselves, well, why are they having the trial in the city of Chernobyl while that is while it's actively in the exclusion zone? Now, there's a Soviet law, there was a Soviet law, because the Soviet Union is not around anymore, that the trial of that a trial basically had to take place in the district in which the crime like had been committed. So it's like essentially like if like imagine like it's a county, and like say like you commit a crime in a county, well, you would have to have the trial take place in that county. And they decided on Chernobyl because they thought that it was, you know, farther away, and plus they also just kind of wanted to show people that it was essentially, you know, safe, and that, you know, the city of Chernobyl was safe to, you know, hold this stuff in, whereas in fact it was definitely not safe. And even to this day, you know, the city of Chernobyl, where the power plant itself actually gets its, you know, name from, I'm pretty sure that this room that they're holding this trial in, which the creator actually had visited when he went to Chernobyl, this stuff is still to this day you know, abandoned, and it's within the exclusion zone of Chernobyl. So now they're basically starting the trial, which essentially takes up the rest of this episode. Is basically going to be Shcherbina, Holmyuk, and Legasov essentially testifying and basically laying out the timeline of what happened to cause the reactor to explode. And one of the things that they're starting off with Shcherbina here is he's essentially describing the fact that we had this safety test that, you know, Nikolai Fomin had signed off on, even though that they knew that, you know, it probably would have been unsafe to continue with that. Now, what Shcherbina here is kind of talking about in his testimony is he is talking, basically kind of laying out how the reactor works, essentially. Essentially, you have the reactor kind of sits within this drum, essentially, and I'm trying to think about it. So it's essentially the reactor core itself is actually housed within this drum. And on the other sides of these drums, you have like all these things, like you have like on the top, you have like the fuel caps and these housings, you know, that kind of holds the fuel caps down, you know, underneath, you know, inside the reactor, you got the fuel rods, the fuel channels. You then also have water pumps, reservoirs around that pump water into the reactor itself. That pump water into the reactor in order to, you know, slow down reactor to cool down the fuel and all that kind of stuff. Now, what Shcherbina here is doing is he's actually describing what the safety test is. Now, again, as we talked about at the beginning of this podcast, the safety test they were talking about was what they call the rundown test, which essentially what, as Shcherbina is describing, it was a test to see how the reactor would have worked at extremely low power. Now, as Shcherbina is mentioning here, this is a test that they've been trying to get done over the last 3 years. In fact, that's something that Brekhanov had actually mentioned when he was talking with Fomin and, you know, Dyatlov at the beginning of the episode, is that they had been trying to get this safety test done. You know, the reactor was open in 1983. They had been trying to get this reactor safety test done within the last essentially 3 years to try and basically sign off that this reactor is good, you know, that it's a working in order reactor. Now, people are wondering, well, why is this, you know, what does the safety test cause, like, or what does the safety test prove, essentially? The safety test essentially was what were to happen if, say, the reactor or, say, like, the power was, like, maybe shut down or something like that. You know, one of the biggest cases, and in fact, what they've talked about a lot in this series is what if we were like attacked and say like our power was knocked out, like how would our reactors handle that? And so that was kind of the basis for the test, was just to see how the reactor would work at low power. But what ended up happening was that they let the power remain too low in the reactor for too long. Because what they ended up doing earlier in the day, and again, earlier in this episode, what we mentioned is that Dyatlov and Fomin were told that we need to keep the reactor running because, again, they need the electricity for these factories in Kiev. And as Dyatlov had mentioned, it's like we're going to maintain the power at about 1,600 megawatts, and then we'll come back and get some sleep. Them maintaining at kind of low power, unfortunately, was causing some what was called basically xenon poisoning to start occurring in the plant, in the reactor itself, which once again is something that we're going to hit on as we go along here. So now we have been transported during the storytelling of Homyuk, and so Shcherbina finished up his testimony. Now Homyuk is giving her testimony. We are now being transported back to the night of the accident, and we're being reunited with Leonid Toptunov and Alexander Akimov, who are, again, so just a reminder, so Akimov is the shift foreman. He's essentially the supervisor of the Unit 4 control room. And Toptunov is the senior control operator. He's basically the guy that's in charge of making sure the reactor itself runs properly and doing all that kind of stuff. And Toptunov they're showing Toptunov just getting into work, and he is just now kind of arriving. Once again, Toptunov was very young. He was only 25 years old. He had only been a senior control operator for about 4 months, and before they got into work that night, they had no clue that there was this test going on of the rundown test. And as they're showing here with Alexander Akimov and with Akimov and Toptunov, is that they're going through the instructions for the rundown test, but they're noticing that a lot of the instructions have been crossed out. And I think we're led to believe that it was Dyatlov himself that actually went through and crossed them out, because again, he's trying to basically kind of cut corners, essentially. So Dyatlov here, he enters the room and he basically tells everybody that we're going to start the test. And Dyatlov is kind of, again, short with his, you know, with the people that he's working with. And he's basically telling them, like, shut the F up, do what you're told. I mean, this is, he was not a likable man to work for. He was very demanding. He was very, you know, vulgar in his language. And, you know, and again, you know, the people that, you know, were working under him that night, I mean, Akimov and Toptunov, you know, they were unprepared for this test. And even one of the people that Dyatlov had started to yell at had basically been telling him, I just learned that we're doing this safety test. I haven't even been able to review. And Dyatlov literally just, you know, throws him, just disgustedly throws him like this, like, book of instructions. And essentially, you know, here, even somebody as stupid as you can figure that out. Or how about you just shut up and do what you're told? So, and I love the Komyuk's kind of analogy that she's kind of comparing Toptunov, the young control operator, to basically Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space. He's like, well, what if Yuri Gagarin had gone to space, but he had knew nothing of his mission? It's like, that's essentially what is happening with the reactor now, is that essentially the people that are you know, in charge of running the test don't really know how to run the test, and they've never run the test before. And not only were the controllers, you know, not prepared, the controllers in the control room number 4 were not prepared, but not everybody even within the plant itself was not prepared. Like, the engineers that were working kind of more closely with the the reactor itself, the people down in the pump rooms, especially the Valery Haldimchuk, the gentleman that was instantly vaporized again when the explosion occurred, you know, he didn't know about it either. So it was this test was once again probably shouldn't have happened, and not only shouldn't have happened, but it also was poorly communicated about. And if it had been better communicated about, I don't think anything would have changed, but I think it would have at least helped out, you know, some people. So Legasov now is gonna give his testimony, and that's essentially what the rest of this episode is about, is essentially Legasov going over what happened within the reactor. And he uses these red and blue cards, essentially. These cards are essentially describing how the reactor works and how, like, essentially kind of how the reactor fuel kind of works and whatnot. So, now these blue and, like, essentially the way that it works is that the red cards essentially are the cards that cause the reactivity to go up, and the blue cards cause the reactivity to go down. Again, the higher the reactivity, the more electricity that is caused. And essentially what he's describing here is that you start with uranium fuel, which then has boron control rods, which then is cooled by water, which then slows down the reactivity. And now he's describing something that is called a positive void coefficient, which in layman's terms, it means essentially that the more steam that is present, the higher the reactivity of the in the reactor itself. And then he also describes he calls out the negative temperature coefficient, which, and it says that, and essentially the negative temperature coefficient means that if the reactor gets hotter, then it gets less reactive, which actually is kind of a bit kind of paradoxical if you think about it. But essentially, he's describing this kind of balance that these reactor engineers are essentially in control of. Essentially, they control the reactivity by letting it go up and go down by the boron control rods that we talked about that cause it to go down. After he kind of basically describes the way that the reactor works itself, he describes now where the problems start to begin with what happened during Chernobyl. So we mentioned they were mentioning the delay that they had in the test because they had to wait until nighttime in order to do this test because of the, factories in Kiev. Now, what Legasov is describing is that there is a buildup of xenon in the nuclear reactor itself. Now, xenon is a neutron absorber. They call it a poison, actually, because it basically poisons the reactor and it basically causes the reactor's, reactivity to go down. Because the reactor had been operating at pretty low power throughout the day, they had allowed this buildup of xenon, and I think I've mentioned this a little bit before, but essentially, there was this pit of xenon within the reactor itself that was built up over the day, and then once they had decided to actually start powering the reactor down, because to run the safety test, they had to power the reactor down to 700 megawatts. They had been holding it 1600 throughout the day, and now they're showing Toptunov and Akimov powering it down to 700. Now, what's going to start to happen is they're lowering the power. They're trying to slowly lower the power down, and then ultimately, what's going to happen is they're going to see the power in the reactor ultimately drop like a stone. It drops down to like 500 megawatts. And it's continually dropping, and the thing is that Toptunov and Akimov they're not touching or moving anything, so they're just, the power's just dropping. And ultimately, this causes another problem for Dyatlov, in which, because basically what's going to end up happening is that the power in the reactor essentially grinds to a halt, and that the reactor they basically talk to LAC control disabled, it's kind of, again, technical jargon that they say here. But then after they switched to local control. And then essentially what ends up happening is that Akimov and Toptunov essentially grinds the reactor. After they press this button to go to local control, they essentially grind the reactor to a halt. Now, the reactor goes back down to zero, basically goes down to 0 megawatts. Now, what ends up happening is, or what should happen when a reactor goes to zero, because, so they've ground the reactor to a halt. What should happen now is that, essentially is they should basically shut the rest of the reactor down, and then essentially wait 24 hours and to slowly power it back up. But Dyatlov, again, wanting to get this safety test done, essentially to get a checklist off so that he can get promoted, or to check something off of a list and so he can get promoted. That's what I should have said. He essentially demands that you guys raise power from zero, which essentially what this tells them is that we need to start pulling control rods out of the reactor. But remember, pulling the control rods out of the reactor is essentially basically relinquishing control of the reactor. The more and more control rods you pull out of the reactor, the less and less control they actually have over said reactor. And now, Andy Atloff, who during this whole time had been complaining about the men procrastinating, complaining about everybody, you know, taking too slow, he essentially demands Akimov to raise the power. And Akimov is said to have been, trying to talk Dyatlov out of it. And ultimately, Dyatlov threatened Akimov with essentially ruin his career. He's essentially telling him, if you don't do what I tell you, then you're not going to work in a nuclear power plant for the rest of your life, and I'll see to it. And I love, and no, I'll back up here. Dyatlov then, in the miniseries here, he essentially tells, Dyatlov kind of interjects while Legasov is telling the story, telling him, and this actually did happen, that I wasn't in the room when they raised the power, I was on the toilet, which is actually not correct. You know, it was confirmed by many people in the control room, Toptanov, Akimov, Stalyarchuk, that, you know, Dyatlov was in the control room, you know, when the power, you know, was when he ordered the power raised, and they basically were telling him that he was in the room. Now, Dyatlov here, again, he's showing them as being very defiant and very standoffish, which is true to what the actual Dyatlov, you know, actually did. And even till his death, Dyatlov never truly took responsibility for his role in the disaster itself. He was always pointing to the flaws in the reactor and the flaws in, you know, the people around him. But he never once took responsibility for the directions he gave, for the actions that he took, even until his death. And Dyatlov survived the disaster, but he didn't live very long after. He only lived until 1995, only about 8 years after the Chernobyl disaster took place. And I believe there's differing accounts of how he died. Some say that he died of a heart attack. Some people say he died of bone marrow cancer. There's different reports of how he died, but the radiation, you could see it kind of later in his days that, you know, he was suffering that. I mean, he had lost basically all of his hair, and that, you know, he was suffering from later in life, you know, the radiation sickness and whatnot. So, now we're having this last kind of beautiful scene here with Stellan Skarsgård and Valery Legasov, in which they're kind of basically in which Legasov kind of, you know, expresses his gratitude for Shcherbina. He basically is telling him that, you know, Boris, out of everybody that actually worked on this, you know, you mattered the most. And again, it goes back to the relationship that these guys had built. I mean, they were in the foxhole. They were fighting this war together, this battle of Chernobyl, in order to contain this disaster, this catastrophic global catastrophe that had taken place. And they had grown really close in their later years. Now, I don't know if they had kept up their friendship kind of later in life, but I do know that once Legasov passed, you know, Boris Shcherbina had nothing but glowing things to say about him. And he said, you know, he was one of the best of us. And, you know, he was a bright example of the Soviet Union. So, and one of the things they're showing here is Shcherbina kind of basically telling Legasov, kind of showing Legasov that, you know, he is in ill health himself. Now, again, we don't know very much about this because, again, Sherbina was kind of secretive about the later parts of his life. They're basically, you know, and he did die, and Sherbina did die shortly after this, you know, trial took place. He only lived for 3 more years after this. And nobody really knows how he died. It was kind of a bit of a secret. In fact, he had actually stated in his will that on his death certificate, when he died, they could not put down because of radiation. They couldn't put that down. So he probably did die from a result of his exposure to radiation at Chernobyl. But you know, we'll never really know for certain. Again, it's a kind of a beautiful little scene here where he basically, these two men are, I think they probably know that this is going to be probably the last time that they talk to each other, you know, and they realize that they don't have much time for this earth anymore. In fact, Legasov only has less than a year to live at this point. And they show what probably is a symbolic image of a centipede on Sherbina's hand that basically, I guess, should symbolize life or something like that. So, I don't know. So we're back into the trial room here, Legasov and Homyuk with Sherbina. And I believe that now it's time, and Legasov is going to continue his testimony. So essentially, we're going back to the timeline here. So at this time, Dyatlov. So to kind of set the stage, Dyatlov had ordered the reactor to essentially to power up the reactor in order to, you know, run the safety test. And as Legasov describes, there is with the reactor, because again the reactor's ground to a halt. It's at very low power. I think they said it's only at 30 megawatts. They have more and more xenon being built up in there, which again lowers the reactivity. And essentially, that throws the balance of how the reactor is to work kind of, you know, out of whack, to where it's basically all poisoned. And now, essentially we get into the phase of the Chernobyl accident where I call the slingshot back and forth method, basically in which they essentially throw this reactor to one extreme, and then they basically slingshot it to the other extreme. And the thing with nuclear power is that this is not how the nuclear power is supposed to work. It's not supposed to slingshot back and forth from one extreme to the other. And so now, as Legasov describes, Dyatlov then orders that Toptunov essentially takes out almost all of the control rods out of, I believe, 211 control rods that were in the plant, that were in the reactor. There were only 206. There were 206 that got pulled out, which left only 5 left remaining. And I remember there was a Russian scientist that basically described the pulling of the control rods out as essentially cooking a gun, because you basically lose any ability to control this thing if you take all those control rods out. Because again, you know, you have all the uranium and stuff inside of the reactor, basically going with no ability to basically stop it and break it and all that kind of stuff. So they try to get the power back on. They pull the control rods out. They try to get the power back on. But Akimov tells Dyatlov that they're only able to get the power back up to 200 megawatts. Now, the power is supposed to be at 700 megawatts in order for them to actually run the test. But again, Dyatlov wants to get this test done, and he wants to get it done now. So he just decides with 200... with 200 megawatts, they want to get the test going now. And essentially what they're doing, and essentially now what they're trying to do is they're starting the power down test, and essentially they're essentially just, what happened was that they had pulled all the control rods out, but they had also turned like the water pumps on. So essentially they had all this water going into the reactor. They had too much water in the reactor. They had all the control rods pulled out. There was just basically way too much. It was just not any ideal circumstances. And they even say it here, and even during the actual test itself, I mean, the test results at this point are essentially useless. And the test itself is basically pointless at this point because, you know, they're not, they're just not following their directions. So it's just not even a proper test at this point. Now, the one thing that Legasov now describes is that Toptanov actually gets a recommendation from the Scala computer, as they call them. It's the SCL, I believe it's the SKALA computer that the Scala computer actually recommended that they basically turn the reactor off and that they eventually stop what they're doing. And now what they're starting to do now is they're now starting the test. Even after all of the, you know, bickering that Dyatlov has given them, you know, all the, you're going too slow, you're procrastinating, now they're starting the test. He even was saying, you know, there would have been half a bunch of people in this plant that would have been, completed the test by now. Now, what they do, because they close those valves down, is that they essentially close down the water supply to the reactor, and they try to let the turbine, kind of spin freely. Without the water in the reactor, along with the control rods not in there, there's no water anymore in there, which then causes steam, which causes the steam to increase in the reactor, which causes the reactivity to increase, which then, as it says, slingshots the reactor from the extreme of being completely grounded to the extreme of being to the extreme of being out of control. And as a result of this, the reactor goes into a power surge, and the power starts to climb immensely. After they shut the water down, the power starts to surge. And then, and Legasov now describes the AZ-5 button that we've been talking about in this whole, the button that's been kind of at the center of the mystery this whole time. The AZ-5, as I've been saying earlier, the AZ-5 button, or as we call it in America, the SCRAM button, it's essentially designed to halt the reactor, to stop the reactor. And when Toptanov and Akimov saw the power start to surge right there, they press down on the AZ-5 button in order to shut down the reactor. And then, as they show again, Dyatlov here being extremely outspoken, extremely, defiant. And Legasov still wants to tell the courts more, but Shcherbina actually kind of stands up and basically allows Legasov to finish his testimony. And now this is when we get into what actually the ultimate explosion of what happened at Chernobyl, because what Legasov now is going to describe is that they saw the power surge, and then Akimov and Toptanov then pressed that AZ-5 scram button, and then, but instead of the power going down as it should have, because that's what it should have done, the power rose. And the power rose, and the power rose, and the power rose, and the way that they're going to describe it, the reactor rose to 3,400 megawatts, and it couldn't, and the reactor inside could not handle the pressure, could not handle the steam pressure anymore, and it basically became like a giant steam pressure cooker at that point. And essentially what ended up happening was is that once they put those fuel rods in, the graphite essentially ends of it, which were basically stuck in the fuel rods, in the fuel channels ruptured, which basically caused the control rods to essentially get stuck. And the graphite, which got stuck in place in the reactor, instantaneously caused the reactivity to go up, and that's ultimately what caused the power surge. The steam, the pressure inside builds up, and ultimately the top of the reactor just pops off. And then essentially they had, you know, air and other things that got kind of sucked into the reactor, and it caused a second explosion that basically ripped the whole building apart. So there are actually two explosions at Chernobyl. There was one where the reactor itself's lid popped off, and then there was a much larger explosion in which air was able to enter, and the whole building just blew apart. And Legasov here basically implicates the Soviet state for why, you know, for essentially the cause here. You know, and that's even what one of the judge here is saying, is that, you know, you're treading into dangerous territory if you're telling us that the state of the Soviet Union is to blame here. And you know, I may have gotten a little bit too far here. Now, this is actually something that's interesting to think about. So in the first episode, I talked about a man named Valery Pervachenko, who had come into the control room, and essentially what he eventually saw, like right before the explosion took place, is what they had these control rod caps that were essentially bouncing up and down, which is something that you should have never seen, because those control rod caps weigh like about a ton, like that weigh just a they weigh so much that they should not be moving up and down at all. And so that's why he ultimately ran into the room to say that the core itself exploded. I saw the control rod caps, you know, bouncing up and down. And so now they basically describe the lid being thrown off, the second explosion, destroying the building, and then that's what caused Chernobyl to happen. Two explosions. A slingshotted reactor that basically was tested, brought to the brink of its limits in one direction, and then basically slingshot back to the brink of its reactivity in another direction. It got out of control, and then it popped its top. So, and then essentially what they're showing here is that that's actually when the series starts, because again, and you can even see the confusion on their faces here, because, you know, they had no idea that they had no idea what could happen. And not only that, like, you could see the confusion on their face there, because, you know, they press that button, the AZ-5 button, and after that, they saw the power surge go up, and then that's when it exploded. So, I mean, you you can imagine the concern on their face, or you can imagine the confusion on their face, because they didn't they had thought that, oh, this is going to stop everything, but in fact it didn't. So I mean, they were dumbfounded when all this took place. So and now Legasov here kind of goes on to his and Legasov here is kind of going off on his little tangent here about, you know, the lies and the cover-ups of, you know, what has happened, you know, with the Chernobyl disaster. And he essentially just, this final monologue of his is like, you know, our secrets and our lies, you know, that they're what define us. And, you know, I love how he ends this, is that he basically tells them that that's how an RBMK reactor explodes. Lies. And you know, that's how people describe, you know, the buildup. It's, you know, just that it's a culture of kind of secrecy, complacency, and ultimately just, you know, sweeping things under the rug. That's how ultimately Chernobyl happened, was that they just, you know, they didn't, you know, and they didn't tell, you know, the controllers, they didn't tell the engineers about this AZ-5 design flaw. They didn't tell them that it could actually be used as a detonator of sorts. And, you know, because of that, you know, ultimately Chernobyl is a disaster of both a bad design flaw within a nuclear reactor as well as human error. You know, again, it's a bit of both. I mean, there's a lot of play. There's a lot of different, you know, factors that ultimately happened at Chernobyl. But, you know, those are basically the two main ones there. So Legasov now has been kind of apprehended by some of the KGB members, because after he kind of basically spilled the beans on, you know, the whole, you know, RBMK reactor design flaw, he essentially is going to be talked to by the, you know, KGB, you know, chairman, essentially. Now, I don't think it happened like this. Now, I'll go back to Legasov, kind of the thing that I started at the beginning of the episode. So, Legasov realized how bad the design flaws were, and he realized how dangerous the nuclear industry was in the Soviet Union. So he then decided that he was going to start to fight it, and he was going to try and make all these changes happen. And it started, and it got to a point, and it wasn't exactly, I don't think, the government or the KGB itself that was pressing down on Legasov, but it was his own scientific community, because he had several members of the community, of the scientific community that he worked with, especially even at that at the Kurchatov Institute, that essentially were, you know, trying to silence him, you know, because a lot of these people, you know, were higher ups, and essentially they would be the ones implicated in the nuclear accident, you know, knowing that there had been safety flaws and safety design and safety flaw designs and all that kind of stuff. Now, and it gets to the point in his, and now Legasov gets to kind of this critical point into this life, in his life, where he starts to essentially get passed up for promotion at the Kurchatov Institute. He actually was supposed to take over as, like, basically one of the lead scientists there, and he doesn't, and partially because of what he did at Chernobyl. He was supposed to get certain commendations. He was supposed to get certain awards for the work that he did at Chernobyl, but that he wasn't getting. And, you know, that's ultimately what caused him to become disillusioned with the whole, you know, government. And that's ultimately what led him to really record his memoirs, was the fact that, you know, he was just so disillusioned with what he had seen with the cover-up and, you know, all the stuff. That's why he put his memoirs on tape, so that someone would know about this. Because, once again, you know, all of the stuff that Legasov has mentioned here, and the KGB chairman here is essentially even telling him that, you know, why that, you know, none of what you say here today is going to be leaked out to the public. Nobody's going to know what has happened here today. So, And so basically, you know, Legasov knows that he's essentially, you know, basically his career is essentially over, that his profession is done. And so it ultimately kind of is a bit of a sad ending to, you know, what's ultimately a very sad story is the story of the Chernobyl disaster. So, but thankfully afterwards, you know, in an unfortunate twist of cruelty, Legasov's suicide ended up, you know, causing scientists and causing people to, you know, really wake up and really actually discover, really take a look at the flaws in the nuclear industry in the Soviet Union. Even to this day, there are still, I believe, 10 RBMK reactors that are essentially the same type of reactor that exploded at Chernobyl. There are still, I believe, about 10 of those that are still in operation at still in this time today. But in the years after Chernobyl, they actually went through and made safety. They made safety changes to them, so that a accident like what happened at Chernobyl wouldn't happen again. And thankfully, other than the Fukushima disaster in Japan during the tsunami and the earthquake there, you know, nothing has come close to matching the catastrophe that Chernobyl, you know, was essentially. So, and I love this kind of parting line of Legasov, basically the last line that we hear that he actually speaks. Why worry about something that's not going to happen? I love Legasov's comeback to what the chairman says here. That's perfect. We should put that on our money, because that's, you know, ultimately what has, that's ultimately what, that's a great line of what not to do in a situation like this. So, and so that basically is going to end the series. I mean, they're going to show Legasov essentially climbing into a car and being driven back to Moscow, and he looks over at Homyuk and Shcherbina, and they never see each other again. Which I don't know if that happened in real life, but once again, I think that's the implications of that. After this took place, and after Legasov essentially was trying to go around telling the truth of everything, they never spoke to each other again. So, and they have this poignant scene of him kind of driving by Shcherbina and Homyuk, and they end with a final taped message from Legasov, not the real Legasov, but, you know, Jared Harris playing Legasov, which again doesn't really match what he actually said in his real life memoir. But the final shot shows a large expanse of land, and then right off in the distance, you see the power plant now all closed up. So, and ultimately, this ending kind of monologue from this kind of ultimately tape thing from Legasov is essentially telling us that the whole thing of this, you know, this whole, you know, miniseries is essentially, you know, telling us that, you know, and even Craig Mazin himself is that, you know, the miniseries is about, you know, lies build up, they build up over time, and, you know, ultimately, you know, a catastrophe like this that happened, you know, it doesn't really care about, you know, the lies. I mean, you can try and cover it up the best you can, but it's ultimately, the truth will come out eventually. Which again, you know, the whole story of Chernobyl, you know, I don't think that we're going to know everything about Chernobyl, but we know a lot now, a lot more now than, you know, especially what we were knowing even like probably 10 or 20 years ago. So, and now we essentially have this kind of epilogue with footage of the real life Legasov and footage of the real life, you know, characters that, you know, we've been following along with. And a lot of the information that they're telling us is essentially information that we have, that I've basically been sharing with you throughout this series. And they were saying that other scientists themselves were even, you know, denunciated, arrested, you know, they were, you know, jailed because of, you know, them speaking out, you know. Not every scientist was against Legasov. There were a lot of scientists that were, you know, that were for Legasov. They were supporting him, and ultimately he, and ultimately several other scientists, you know, met a similar fate to Legasov as well, so. Boris Shcherbina died August 22nd, 1990, 4 years, 4 months after he was sent to Chernobyl. Once again, he did not allow them to put the fact that he died of radiation on his birth certificate. Brekhanov, Dyatlov, and Fomin, they were all three sentenced to 10 years of imprisonment after the trial. Fomin actually was released early. He actually had a mental breakdown within his prison camp. And I believe Fomin is actually still alive to this day. I think Viktor Brekhanov, I think, died about a year ago, actually. And then they're showing Dyatlov here later in his life with no hair, very little hair, and he died in 1995. Valery Hadamchuk's body was never recovered. He was the only person whose body was never recovered. He has a permanent, memorial in the basement of Chernobyl, close to where he died. They're showing the firefighter's clothing from episode 2 that the doctors had taken off and essentially had put in the basement there. And even to this day, those firefighter's clothing from that episode, it's still dangerously radioactive. And a lot of the stuff in Chernobyl, you know, it's, you know, you can only stay in certain areas for a certain amount of times. Now, you can go to Chernobyl, the exclusion zone, and they have, like, tours set up. There's actually people that still work at the power plant itself. But, you know, it's very limited tours, and, you know, you got to have, like, a guide. You know, you're subject to several, you know, radiation checkpoints throughout the, throughout your stay there. Now, this is another stat here. They're showing kind of a stat of the miners that were digging the tunnels underneath the reactor. They state that that approximately they had 400 miners, essentially those guys that were digging underneath the tunnel. Essentially, they estimated that 100 of them basically died before the age of 40, you know, because of radiation sickness and whatnot. They talk about the liquidators. 600,000 men and women were conscripted to serve in the exclusion zone for the liquidation process that we talked about in episode 4. Again, no record of their demise has been kept. The exclusion zone to this day is an area 2,600 square kilometers. And then they had 3,000 people that were displaced from their homes. Actually, they literally built another city very much like Chernobyl that, right afterwards. And even to this day, several people that were living in Pripyat when Chernobyl happened, you know, still live in this city. I believe it's Slavutovich. I'm not sure. Slavuch or something like that. It's some city along those that name. But it was a city that's very much a lot like what Pripyat was. It was, you know, an Atomgrad. It's a city that was, you know, meant to house the people of the nuclear of that work at the power plant nearby. And they were showing Mikhail Gorbachev there, another little quote of him saying that one of the quotes that he said is that the disaster at Chernobyl was essentially the cause of the start of the cause of the downfall of the Soviet Union. It was that along with, you know, some of the, like, you know, openness that he was starting to allow in. And it was, I think, only less than 5 years after Chernobyl happened, you know, the Soviet Union collapsed. And the last thing they leave us with is they don't really know how many people really were affected by Chernobyl. You know, the official death toll to this day is 31. But some people estimate that the long-term deaths and disease range from 4,000 to 93,000. Although some people have said that the 93,000 figure is a little bit much, still there's been a ton of people that have been affected by this, and you know, in memory of all who suffered and sacrificed. So, and that'll do it. That's Chernobyl. So that'll be the it. That's it for Chernobyl. And again, for as the title at the end here said, you know, in a memory, you know, going out to all those people that even to this day are still affected by this, the family members that of those that died, the 31 men that died as a result of the radiation, the people that did their best to, you know, the people that sacrificed themselves in order to basically save millions of lives, because if they hadn't done that, then, you know, many people would have died. So that has been Chernobyl. It has been a blast to watch this series with you guys. If you had gotten through this series of episodes this far and you have not watched Chernobyl, I highly recommend that you go back and watch all five of these episodes. It is a great miniseries. It's available on HBO Max. You can also purchase it on YouTube. I don't know how much on YouTube, but if you also have an HBO Max account, you can also order it there as well. So, thank you guys again for listening, for watching. It means the world to me that you guys are listening to these podcasts. I appreciate every single one of you. Please, again, reach out if you have any recommendations for episodes, you know, for movies, miniseries for me to watch. I'll do my best to get to them as soon as possible. And we'll go from there. All right. Guys, thank you so much for following along. Thank you guys so much for listening to this series with me. I hope you guys are staying good to each other out there. Stay good to yourselves. Be good to each other. Stay golden out there, and I'll see you on the flip side.